Still bad. And we're back with you on Community Watch and Comment. I'm Dave Rabin. Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts has said that, quote, the way to stop discrimination on the basis of race is to stop discrimination on the basis of race. And he and others are using this rationale to cut back on race-based affirmative action. But there are some, including the Economic and Policy Institute's Richard Rothstein, who assert that race still needs to be in the mix when it comes to affirmative action. Richard Rothstein joins us now. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Good morning.
Good morning. So before we launch into the race versus class affirmative action distinction, could you give a rundown for folks that might not be up on it exactly where we are in terms of the Supreme Court and affirmative action?
Well, the Supreme Court has taken the position that except in cases where a specific individual can show that he or she was discriminated on account of his or her race, preferences cannot be extended to African Americans as a group in university admissions. What they have said is that if universities are trying for educational purposes to create a diverse educational environment and are looking at a variety of factors that will create campus diversity, as they want to have some violin players and some athletes, they can have some blacks as well, and so they can use race for that purpose only. Now, that's only because there's one swing vote on the Supreme Court that would permit that, but that's the law at this point.
Okay.
But there's a prohibition from the court on specifically giving preferences to African-American applicants.
Right, and the idea there of allowing for race to be considered in creating diversity is that it seemed to be an important educational dynamic to have that kind of diversity in the school setting.
Yes, the court has allowed that, as I say, for educational purposes, but it's very clear that this use of race is not to be used for purposes of remediating past discrimination against African Americans or compensating for a history in this country of race-based policy, slavery, Jim Crow discrimination, and so
right.
forth. That is not permitted. It's
right.
only permitted to use race for purposes of creating a diverse student body, and it has to be done with a very light hand.
Right. You can't. A university can't say we're going to have 10% people of color or African American
right.
in
right.
order to create that diversity.
That's correct.
Right. And you basically don't agree with that. Your general opposition to that idea.
Well, this country has not yet confronted or remediated the caste system that we created historically for African Americans. African Americans are underrepresented in, and we're talking about, by the way, let me say parenthetically, we're talking about selective universities. This is the only place where it matters. Obviously, a university or any high school graduate can be admitted. But this doesn't affect them. But for selective universities, African Americans are underrepresented. And they're underrepresented because of a history of unconstitutional practices. In the review I wrote of Cheryl Cashin's book, In the American Prospect, which is where this current controversy was most recently aired, I described the situation of the suburb of Levittown in New York. It's well known nationwide. It was created in 1947. 17,000 homes built for returning World War II veterans in the suburbs of New York City. The federal government required the Levitt Company, Levitt and Sons, to prohibit sales in this development of 17,000 homes to African Americans. This was not private prejudice. This was a federal requirement. environment. The FHA gave Leavitt financing, guaranteed financing to Leavitt to construct this development on condition that no homes be sold to African Americans.
You know, it's kind of, yeah. I'm sorry, isn't
let me
it?
Just finish. Let me yeah. just, I think it's important. Yeah. Let me just finish this yeah. example, and then we can
no, it is important.
Further.
Absolutely.
At the time these homes were sold, in 1947, they were sold for $7,000 apiece to returning war veterans, white war veterans only. That, at the time, was 2.5 times national median family income. Today, homes in Levittown, which, by the way, today is still only 1% black, in a metropolitan area that's close to 25% black. Today, those homes sell for $400,000 apiece, which right. is roughly 7 times national median income. The white families who were permitted to buy into Levittown in the 1940s and 1950s have benefited from a half century of housing appreciation, which far exceeded inflation, which developed the wealth that white families have, which gives an enormous advantage to their children in being able to attend and compete for competitive colleges, having that kind of wealth.
Right.
Black families, who were forced to live in the ghetto because they were equally able and qualified, returning war veterans with good jobs, to purchase homes in Levittown that time, did not acquire that equity and did not benefit from a full half century of appreciation and wealth. And as a result, black wealth, Levittown was not an exception. This was the rule in these mass developments that created across the country. As a result, black families have a tiny fraction of the wealth of white families at the same income. Now, that directly affects the ability of African-American children to compete for selective colleges. And so there are many, many examples like this, of unconstitutional discrimination against African-Americans that still have effects today. And that's why, in order to compensate for this, in order to undo this damage, it's necessary to offset the disadvantage of the lack of accumulation of wealth that black families have in offering them admission, if they're qualified. Now, one thing that I should be clear about is that affirmative action is not and should not be used to offer admission to unqualified applicants. But for every qualified applicant to selective universities, there are many, many equally qualified applicants who are not accepted. We have very many, many more qualified applicants selective universities, and there are spaces for them. And as anybody knows who has a child who's applied for these colleges and is qualified, whether you get in is really mostly a matter of chance.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of taking qualified African Americans and trying to ensure that they are well represented in the pool of accepted applicants of qualified students is a constitutionally required, in my judgment, a constitutionally required action to undo several centuries of unconstitutional discrimination against them whose effects are still perpetuated today.
Mm-hmm. What do you say to those that say we can take care of those egregious injustices in the past by focusing on class, that if we make sure that we have a good mix, the Supreme Court, I don't believe, has said that you can't use class, economic income, et cetera, and even possibly wealth as a way of getting a good mix. If you focus on making sure that you have lower income people in the mix, then you're going to get a sufficient racial mix. Your response to that?
Well, I have two responses. One is that there's a constitutional obligation to undo the effects of centuries of race-based discrimination. Using class is a voluntary policy that universities may or may not adopt, but there is no constitutional requirement that they do so. That's the first point I make. So simply using class may or may not, even if it did take care of the problem as you described, it's still an optional policy. It's not a requirement in can't be seen as a requirement, but a proper interpretation of the Constitution would require affirmative action.
Can you explain that a little bit more, what you mean by a constitutional requirement to...
I'm using the example of Levittown that I gave before only as an example. It's typical of what went on nationwide, not just in home building, but in many areas. But the federal government's requirement that Levitt sell homes only to whites and not to African Americans was a violation of African Americans' rights under the 14th and 13th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution. It was unconstitutional federal action.
Right.
And so it requires a remedy. It requires a remedy, not an optional remedy. The idea of using class instead of race for college admissions is a policy that colleges may or may not adopt. But they're not, there's no constitutional argument that they have to adopt it. And other lower-income families are not lower income and do not have low wealth because of this kind of unconstitutional action. They may have low wealth. They may have low income. But the reason for it is not a explicit federal policy that violated their constitutional rights. So that's the first point I'd make. The second point I'd make is that it simply doesn't have the effect that its proponents claim. Using class does not sweep up enough qualified African Americans to take care of the remedy that's required. In California, for example, with which I'm quite familiar, use of emphasis and recruitment of low-income families sweeps up large numbers of deserving Latino children, deserving Asian children, and a much smaller proportion of African Americans, simply because they're Asians and Latin American children are so numerous in the state.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't do it with a class base. There are many more non-black poor people in this country than there are black poor people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The two points that I just want to make sure I understand and our listeners understand. You say the problem of underrepresentation of blacks is primarily in selective universities versus what more mainstream, middle-of-the-road universities. If you could talk about that difference.
Well, what I'm saying is that the affirmative action is relevant only in universities where students are admitted primarily on the basis of SAT scores or college grades, and many, many more students apply than can be accepted. In lower tiers of our higher education system, where anybody who graduates from high school is entitled to admission to a state college or to a community college, this doesn't apply. This only applies to universities that are highly selective, in which there are many qualified African Americans who are not admitted just because there are lots of qualified people of all races who are not admitted.
Mm-hmm.
And so in order to boost the share of those qualified African Americans who are admitted, affirmative action is required.
In response to the folks that are arguing for a more class-oriented affirmative action, it's not just in general that African Americans are not well represented in that system. It's even more specifically, if I understand you correctly, it's the middle-class blacks that are being left out. If you could talk about that.
Well, all African Americans are underrepresented in these highly selective universities. So what I was talking about, which I think what you're referring to, is that the state of Texas, for example, has attempted to evade the Supreme Court's ruling by admitting the top 10%, it's actually not exactly 10%, but the top 10%, we can, for the purpose of the discussion, say, of every high school graduating class in the state. And because high schools are so highly segregated, they do get African Americans who were the top 10% of students who were graduating from highly segregated all black high schools. But the most segregated high schools in the state of Texas tend to be the lowest income, the high schools and the most right. ghettoized. And so what you do when you have this 10% plan, which is fine as far as it goes, is that you get low-income African-Americans living in ghettoized communities where the schools they attend are highly segregated, but you don't pick up the middle-class African-Americans who are living in more integrated communities and who are not likely to dominate necessarily the top 10% of their high schools. The middle-class African-Americans, though, tend to be much better prepared, because this is true throughout our society. We have a class structure in the society, and middle-class children come to school with much more preparation, and they achieve at typically higher levels than low-income families. So what you do is you get a large numbers of students in this 10% plan who come from the lowest income communities, from segregated high schools, who require remediation and special efforts to assimilate them into the university, and you overlook qualified African-American students from middle-class communities who would fit in quite well to the university without remediation. They're fully qualified. And right. so it's not that the 10% plan is a bad thing, but it does not accomplish the purpose of affirmative action for African-Americans that a race-based policy would do.
Right. We are out of time, but just real briefly, if you could give us some idea if there's any possibility of the ideas that you're talking about being implemented by this Supreme Court. It seems, Sotomayor and Ginsburg, but it doesn't seem like there's a critical mass in the offing for the kinds of things you're talking about.
Well, that's a very short-term perspective. I think that the current Supreme Court, there is no case coming up before this Supreme Court in any event. The current Supreme Court, as we started out in this discussion, takes the position that race-based affirmative action is not permissible. But the Supreme Court could change, and it's not going to change, if advocates of racial justice, as I said, throw in the towel and say that we don't need affirmative action. Because if advocates of racial justice say we don't need affirmative action, a future Supreme Court is certainly not going to lead the way for them.
Right.
We are, perhaps one seat away from a different majority on the Supreme Court. I'm not predicting that that will happen. Mm-hmm. But my main concern is that if informed opinion of people who were committed to racial justice is not advocating this, the Supreme Court is not going to lead right. where they're afraid to speak up.
I want to thank you so much. We're unfortunately out of time. I'd like to have you for the whole hour, but it's important, interesting stuff. I've been speaking with Economic Policy Institute's Richard Rothstein. He's also at the law school at the UC Berkeley, I believe. The Earl Warren Institute, I'm not giving the full name there, but and he's got a couple of articles, one, a dialogue with an opponent, and one of his own, in the American Prospect. Do check them out. Richard Rothstein, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. And coming up, Eleanor Holmes Norton, representative in the Congress here in the district, is going to talk about the situation in Ferguson, Missouri. Stay tuned. And we're back with you here on Community Watch and Comment. I'm Dave Rabin. The killing of an unarmed black man, Michael Brown, by a white policeman in Ferguson, Missouri, has brought the question of race back into the national limelight. And joining us to talk about Ferguson and race in D.C. is D.C. Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton. Thank you very much for taking the time.
Always a pleasure.
Appreciate it. In 1968, during the Johnson administration time, both you and I can recall, the Turner Commission came out with a report in response to racial unrest that was broad spread during that time. And the commission famously talked about two nations separate and unequal. Do you still think that's the case?
Well, we certainly are seeing them emerged in one suburban community, Ferguson, where we see at least two or three different Fergusons. We see a suburban black community that moved from the city trying to get what whites have been able to get since the 1950s. We see a lower middle class Ferguson. We see a Ferguson of unemployed black males. We see people who so value their community that they stood in front of some of the stores in order to keep them from being looted. So we definitely are seeing two Fergusons, but we're also seeing two Americas. We see a Ferguson where the police force is largely white, where most of the elected officials are white, and that's something I can't understand. And that's played out even in what amounts to a small suburban town. This is not St. Louis, this is not D.C. or L.A. or New York. This is a small suburban town, and they've had to send in the National Guard to quell a disturbance in a small part of the community while the major part of the community marches peacefully. So, yeah, we are still seeing the manifestations of two separate Americas. And as long as blacks and whites are not at parity in income and in health care, we're going to see those two Americas played out at scenes like this.
I mean, it is extraordinary. I don't know if people are aware. What there's like three African-Americans on a police force of, what, 53, and there's very few blacks in the city council. Any understanding of how that's come about?
Well, this we really have to look into because I don't know if there's something about the way in which elections are conducted in the county. But normally, if you have a community to experience that kind of racial turnover, one of the first signs of presence of the African-American community you see are the elected officials. And here you have almost none. Now, I certainly hope that's not their fault. I tell you one thing. If I was in Ferguson, the first thing I'd be doing is registering people to vote.
Right. Well, you have a background in that.
Indeed.
Right. Indeed. I mean, it's weird, you know, just... program that you're featured in is on PBS on the anniversary of Freedom Summer. You've got what Mississippi now has more black people in political office than any other place in the Union.
And
up north, and it's maybe you don't call it north, but up in Missouri, it's just not the case.
Yeah, something's wrong with that. But yeah. I'm very proud of what Mississippi has done. It does tell you what African Americans can do. Once they get access and take part in the political process. I'm very worried, though, about Ferguson, about what we don't know about these suburban African-American communities, about the absence of community policing, about what kind of community it is that would leave a boy in the street for 5 hours before they take the body out.
Right.
About peaceful protesters being faced with policemen dressed to kill. I mean, you know.
with German shepherds. I mean, it just smacks of the 60s and
South. Really does. And
I
that's where your analogy there is right on point.
Yeah. So, are you happy with the federal response? I guess Attorney General Holder's going out there tomorrow. What do you think about the federal response?
Well, about the only response I think that's been appropriate and commendatory is the federal response. The governor was AWOL for 5 days. I couldn't tell you who the county leader or the mayor of that small town are. And those are the leaders you'd expect to be on the street with the people that you hear on television. Whereas the FBI has, the president announced, or at least Mr. Holder announced, from the very beginning that there would be a parallel investigation by the Justice Department. And FBI has had agents on the ground now for days. The president is sending out Attorney General Holder himself, which is, I think, the appropriate response. So I do think the federal government's response has been appropriate, but I cannot say the same for the state
right.
and for the local administrative officials. To their credit, my colleague in the Black Caucus has been on the ground. The legislative officials have been on the ground. But if you had that kind of outbreak in America, you'd expect to see your mayor on the ground first
right.
and foremost
right.
before you saw anybody else. So here I would have expected to see on the ground local elected officials, and I certainly would have expected the governor be there every day.
Right.
Now, that local leadership,
right.
civilian control of the police, has been altogether missing from Ferguson.
Someone I heard on the BBC, actually a local professor, Kathy Schneider, just talking about what happened in New York after, I'm not sure which killing of a black individual this was, but there was a lot of unrest, or there was going to be, and Mayor Dinkins immediately went to the home of the parents of the victim, and it calmed things a lot.
And I haven't seen anything like that happen
right,
here.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And it's in the context of very strong arm police tactics. We're running out of time. I know you have a busy day. Just real briefly, I hear on another note that you have a job fair coming up.
Yeah, well, speaking of joblessness,
yes.
which I think is part and parcel of what's at work at Ferguson, you do have provocateurs who appear to come in from the outside.
Right.
But we're trying to get ahead of things like that. I have an annual job fair, and it's coming off on Thursday the 21st, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m., and we're going to have real jobs with openings, and openings of every kind, from bus operators to fully professional jobs. And it's going to be at the convention center. That's right downtown near New York Avenue. People have to, you have to be a D.C. resident, however. You have to have proof that you're a D.C. resident. We can't handle the whole region.
Right. No outside provocateurs.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Everybody should dress for success. We're having an hour with tips about how to get jobs and where the jobs are. And then from 11 to 3, it's one-stop shopping for jobs on Thursday the 21st, 10 to 3 p.m., Convention Center.
Sounds good. And where can people get more information on that?
And call our office at 225-8050. Be glad to hear from you.
Wonderful. We're going to leave it there. I've been speaking with D.C. Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton. Thanks for joining
us. Always good to talk with you.
Take care. And coming up, three economic charts that might surprise you. Stay tuned.
Excuse me, buddy, but where can I be? You fooling, ain't you? This ain't America. Oh, Lord, where can I be? This ain't America. You can't fool me. In America, folks don't run through the streets, blood streaming from where they've been beat. And the cops in the good old USA don't think they some kind of gods either. No, this ain't America. You can't fool me. Those words were written 44 years ago by Melvin Van Peebles for his album As Serious as a Heart Attack, and they sound like they were written last week. Life imitates art. Something's gone rotten. Smells like justice and liberty. The song continues as if the author could see decades into the future to the moment when a Staten Island cop used a chokehold that was forbidden by his own department to murder Eric Garner, whom he suspected of selling loose cigarettes. Loose cigarettes? I can't breathe, Garner complained. He lay dying in the street, emergency medical technicians watching but doing nothing to assist him. This ain't America. You can't fool me. Could Van Peebles have seen Ferguson, Missouri last week, where police officer Darren Wilson shot unarmed 18-year-old Michael Brown down like an animal, according to witnesses, who said Brown's arms were raised over his head in surrender? No, Van Peebles had no crystal ball. Hands up, don't shoot, protesters declared. Love, that's America. It's what the song is called, but you couldn't prove that by the 51-year-old woman who was beaten senseless by a cop on the side of a highway. You couldn't prove that by the dead man who held a toy gun in a Walmart store until he was murdered by police. Love, that's America, Van Peebles declared, but you couldn't prove that by me. And so now the nation seethes. 49 years to the day after the Watts riot boiled over in Los Angeles, leaving 30 dead and 3,000 arrested because of this same kind of police brutality. What century are we living in? What country is this? Excuse me, buddy, but where can we be? This ain't America. You can't fool me. I'm Askia Muhammad, WPFW News Director.
Community Watch and Comment. I'm Dave Rabin. There are certain economic political assumptions out there. Democrats are big spenders. Republicans are frugal. Democrats increased the deficit. Obama's stimulus legislation didn't work. But the Campaign for America Future, Dave Johnson, challenges these assumptions in a recent article, three charts to email to your right-wing brother-in-law. And he joins us now. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
I appreciate it. So I guess the most important question is, do you have a right-wing brother-in-law?
No, but I do get a lot of these email forwards from right-wingers. You know, they circulate everywhere, and I try to get on some of the lists, you know, partly for fun, but partly
right.
Because I'm well aware of a lot of these budget facts. And it's just very interesting to watch how they do this, how they trick people, and how it spreads. So a few years ago, I did a post called Three Updated Charts to Email to Your Right-Wing Brother-in-Law, and it went kind of viral. And even a lot of right-wing sites put up their usual stuff to try to refute it. And I decided, you know, we've got this election coming. Pretty important, so why don't I update this post? And do you want me to give you a quick rundown of what's in it?
Well, let's I guess yeah, let's start with the first one at one at a time here, so we don't overwhelm folks.
Sure.
Particularly because we're talking about economics, which people can kind of glaze over sometimes, but are fun. I mean, it's pretty pretty interesting stuff, and I should say you're basing this on U.S. Government data, correct?
Right, right. It's just the facts, the budget numbers, the deficit numbers. It just is what it is.
Right.
Yeah.
So let's go to government spending. Compare Bush with Obama. We would think, well, of course, Bush being a Republican tend to be cutting down on spending, and Obama would be upping the ante. But what do the numbers show?
Well, the numbers show that under President Bush, spending increased 88%. Under President Obama, up to now, spending has increased 3.78%.
It's really, I mean, so what are, if you do the math,
yeah, I know,
there,
yeah,
it's like,
yeah,
what,
kind of,
it's 20 times, kind of something
speechless.
Like 20 times larger.
Yeah,
something
yeah, and
like
that's
that.
Kind of speechless by the actual numbers. Because
I mean, it's quite extraordinary. And
because you go out there and all they talk about is Obama spending, and you know, come on. here's the thing. First of all, Bush doubled the defense budget. They call it, you know, the military budget. He doubled it, and that's not counting the war. He just
that's
doubled
not
it before
counting the wars.
Counting the wars, right?
Okay.
Just start there, and you get the idea.
Right.
So, yeah. Yeah.
Well,
so,
I mean, if there were a critic of yours sitting here, he or she would say, well, of course he did. The country was under attack. We needed to muscle up. You're just a wimpy tree hugger, and if Bush hadn't been in there, we wouldn't be properly defended.
Well, first of all, the the budgets were submitted, the budget ideas about doubling the military budget were before 9/11, and based apparently on the idea that we do have to defend against the Soviet Union. I mean, that is important.
Right.
Yeah, except that the Soviet Union has been gone a long time. But the point being that these repeated points of what I'll call disinformation are out there, and they're out there because people believe government spending is bad. Now, I want to add, we'll get to this later, but I added a section that I didn't have before on this whole idea that people believe government spending is bad. Yes, spending a lot of money on the military, that's ridiculous, but there's a point.
Well, I mean, it depends on the context. Arguably, in World War II, it wasn't. I mean,
no, exactly. And in this world, of course, you need a military budget. But doubling the military budget for no real reason, etc. You know, when you have government spending in a democracy, this is the most important thing for people to get. In a democracy, by definition, government spending is things that we've decided to do to make our lives better. Okay, that's something people don't get. They've been trained to believe that government spending is a bad thing. As you know, well, no. I mean, why else in a democracy? And I want to emphasize in it, when we have the choice, we would decide. What are we going to decide to spend on things that hurt us? No. Government spending is by definition the things we do to make our lives better. Now you get a Bush in there, and you get corporate money involved, and that starts to get skewed. But let's remember, I'm not criticizing Bush's spending increases or Obama's spending any increase. And I'm not criticizing. All I did with this chart was just lay out these are the facts, and these facts just happen to refute Republican talking points.
Okay. How much of this 88% increase, what, over 8 years under President Bush, how much of that was there was a big bill for Medicare drug expansion.
Right. That was probably a lot of it. And point out that Medicare drug expansion actually had huge subsidies for the pharmaceutical companies. As I said, when corporate money can influence, you know, the decision-making, things go in a different direction. But all I'm doing with this is I'm just saying, hey, wait a minute, that's not the facts.
Right. So you don't have a breakdown. I'm not seeing a breakdown here of what of what that 88% was allocated for.
Right. No.
But you are saying you did start off by saying that a lot of it's the military.
He did double the military budget, but yeah, a lot of it was, well, not a lot of it, some of it.
Right.
Some of that increase in spending on this chart is the worst. But he doubled the military before the wars. So that gives you some idea. I mean, things went kind of wild when Bush had, you know, a Republican House, Republican Senate, and Bush. And they just went kind of wild spending on a spending spree of corporate favors and such.
Which is why George W. Bush is not near and dear to the Tea Party wing of the Republican establishment. I mean, he was... quite this. My memory is a little foggy here. How was Bush was moving towards, or was actually able to implement a doubling of the defense budget before 9/11?
The budget proposals of Bush were to increase the military budget. Now, the budget, of course, was not. I don't even remember if the budget was implemented before 9/11.
I doubt it. But over his term.
He doubled it, and before 9/11, they were talking about the need to increase military.
They were talking about it, but you needed 9/11 to implement.
Right, but the emphasis was not on terrorism at that time, before 9/11. It was just, we got to increase military spending.
Right.
The usual.
I should say we'd love to hear from folks, 202-588-0893. Please give us a call. Your comments, your questions would be more than welcome. 202-588-0893. Need to hear from folks out there so we don't think we're just speaking in a dark hole here at WPFW. I mean, I know we're not, but give us a call. Your next chart is on the deficits. Let's give people who might be glazing over a deficit. What's the exact definition?
The deficit is the amount that the government has authorized, the Congress authorizes that we're going to spend on this year. And then the Congress, you know, we also have taxes, but as the year goes by, they might not have the money coming in from taxes to cover what is authorized to be spent. So then they go out and sell bonds to raise money. They borrow the money to meet the budget that they have authorized. So then it's called a deficit because you have less coming in and more going out. So it's the country borrows a certain amount of money, and we've been doing that since Reagan, except under the years of Bill Clinton. We went into a huge surplus towards the end of Bill Clinton's term, and in fact would have paid the debt off by now. The entire United States debt would have been paid off by now under Clinton's surplus.
Right. So deficit is annual, and debt is the overarching money that are owed by the government.
Yeah, every year, if you borrow money over several years, you know, you're adding to a total debt that you owe. Like if you borrow money on your credit card every month, after a while, you got a whole bunch you owe. And so the whole bunch you owe is the debt, and the borrowing is the deficit.
Right. And so tell us what happened under George Bush.
When George Bush left office, the 2000, here's where people get really confused. Obama took office in 2009, and the 2009 budget year had a huge deficit. But here's where people get confused. The U.S. government operates on what's called a fiscal year. Their eyes glaze over. But the whole point being that the 2009 budget was decided and started before President Obama took office. By the time President Obama took office, that year the deficit was $1.4 trillion. Bush's last budget had a $1.4 trillion deficit, and that budget year ends in September 1st, or October 31st. So the 2009 budget was Bush's last budget. It's the budget that had the huge deficit, and now the deficit is way down. It's around, I don't remember the number.
I think we're talking half a trillion?
No, I think it's down in the threes for this coming year. But you get the point that it's down by more than two-thirds. It's dramatically reduced. And also, the economy has grown. So as a percentage of the economy, Bush had a 10% of the economy deficit, and Obama's got it down to, I think, 2%.
Let's reiterate what the deficit was when Mr. Bush came in 2001. The envelope, please. What was the deficit in 2001?
There was no deficit. We had a huge budget surplus. And one more point on that: when his budget had passed, remember his huge tax cuts, etc. He said, "This is a quote." I don't have the quote in front of me. He said it was like something like an awesome, he called it incredibly positive news. Here's why. Under Reagan, when they created the first huge deficits by cutting taxes and increasing military spending, they called it strategic deficits. Go Google the words strategic deficit. They said they wanted, and Reagan used the words, we want to cut the government's allowance. They said they wanted to create a panic over deficits, get people really scared about government borrowing, and then they would accept doing things like cutting back on Social Security, Medicare, and all the other things government does. Bush said the same thing. Google the words incredibly positive news, and you'll find out that once Bush found out these deficits were starting, he said, this is great because, in the words were, he'll put a straight jacket on Congress. They did this on purpose to create a scare so that people would think, oh, God, we've got to cut back on the government. They said so. They did this on purpose. And this is why, when Bush is spending all this money, you don't hear a thing from Republicans about, oh, the spending, oh, my God. It's only when Obama got in that you started hearing about, oh, these deficits are going to kill us. Oh, God. And the reason is they want to cut back on government doing things for us because that leads to taxes on the rich. So there you go.
Right. I mean, I think there was some noise. It wasn't a critical mass that commission with the former senator from Wyoming, Simpson, I think.
That was under Obama. That's
under Obama. Okay.
Yeah.
I stand
because
corrected.
They were getting everybody whipped up into this terrible, oh, God, the deficit. And that's where we get into later parts of my post, which we might have time to get into. But the fact is that the budget deficit and borrowing are not necessarily so bad, you know, especially when people are unemployed and they need help and things like that. It's when the economy's booming, that's when you want to balance the budget and start paying off some of the borrowing, which is exactly what Clinton did.
Right. And when you want to implement certain programs, like we went, I mean, World War II, we must have extraordinary deficits.
Right.
Right.
And
we
grew the economy later.
Right.
You know, it paid off. So there we are.
Right. So right. You've got Obama, just to reiterate, going from $1.4 trillion down to, I think your chart says, you know, around a half a trillion, but you're saying that it's now even lower than that.
Yeah, it's looking and lower.
And of course, that's happened despite the fact, and it'll be talked about more in the next chart, but that he implements a serious $800 billion stimulus program, I think it was,
right.
and of course the Affordable Care Act.
Right.
So it's not like he's been sitting on his hands, but
right.
Despite some serious infusion of government resources into the economy, the deficit has gone down.
Yeah, and even at the $500 billion, it's down by a third of what it was. So yes, then the next chart is the stimulus, and it just simply shows jobs. That under Bush, at the end of Bush's term, we were losing 850,000 jobs a month.
Right.
I mean, think about that. And then you hear about, oh, we lost all these jobs under Obama. Well, yeah, for the first several months, of course we did, because he came in at 850,000 a month job loss. Now, this chart shows private sector jobs. Public sector jobs, it's even worse, because they were just laying off government people, you know, left and right, and they still were under Obama because of these deficit scares. But
I mean, they still are. I mean,
yeah, right.
Right? I mean, not
right.
Even past tense, right?
Under every previous recession, Reagan, Bush 1, Bush 2, etc., one of the things they did to help people was the government would hire more people, because that helps keep the unemployed down, it helps keep people in the economy paying taxes, spending money, etc., etc. This time we massively laid off government employees, which is one of the bigger reasons that we're still in the middle of these economic doldrums.
And when we say we, we're not talking just about the federal government. We're talking state
right.
and local as well.
That's right.
Yeah.
So the chart here shows what happened when the stimulus kicked in, and it's just an amazing thing to see this deep V going down, down, down under Bush, 850,000 jobs a month, and then this huge reversal directly tied to when the stimulus was out there, you know, construction companies for highways, et cetera, et cetera. Now, keep in mind, a third of that stimulus was tax cuts that nobody knows about, but kind of wasted. But, you know, he said he was trying to attract Republican votes, so he threw in $300 billion of tax cuts, which didn't get any Republican votes.
And tax cuts to who exactly?
It was kind of an across the board, mostly on the lower end, tax cuts.
I should say we have time for a caller if anyone wants to chime in, 202-588-0893. I also should have said this at the beginning of the interview. Check out these charts on daily costs, that DAILYKOS.com. Three charts to email to your right-wing brother-in-law by Dave
yeah.
Johnson. It's quite amazing seeing it represented visually.
Right, or at ourfuture.org, which is where I'm employed.
Okay.
Yeah. What you see then is that the dramatic turnaround in employment from the stimulus, like you can't believe how much that stimulus did for jobs. but it wasn't enough. And it levels off at about, you know, between 100 and 200,000 jobs a month created. We went from losing 850,000 jobs a month. The stimulus brought that up over some time. It's like a V to over 100,000 jobs a month since.
Okay.
But then it just levels off as the stimulus levels off.
Mm-hmm. Well, if your right-wing brother-in-law was sitting here, you'd say, well, you know, correlation is not necessarily causation,
right.
How do you know that this job growth wouldn't have happened anyway? How can you prove that it was the stimulus that caused things to get turned around?
Well, part of it is because most of those people that were hired by the stimulus. That's a good part of that. But there's a lot of things you can say there. And they say you can lie with statistics. That's true. But the thing you can't do with statistics or anything is say that the deficit went up under Obama and that spending dramatically increased under Obama, because they didn't.
Okay.
That, in my opinion, by the way, which is the rest of this post, is a bad thing. Yeah, the rest of the post shows how this, it's called austerity, you know, like they're doing to Greece and across Europe, about how these cuts in government spending are actually what held the economy back from really taking off to where it ought to be now. To why do we have this huge amount of unemployment? Why, you know, the government isn't hiring people. The government isn't helping the long-term unemployed. At a time when the people need this help, government cut back. So I just want to emphasize that that's the difference between this